This podcast is produced by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. A fee-only registered investment advisor, receiving no other payments or hidden fees, so they can put their clients' interests first. And now, today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the March 16th edition of Invest Talk. I do appreciate you being with me. Above average investing for the average investor is our motto here on Invest Talk. We try to answer your questions live during this hour, 4 to 5 Pacific time, or you can leave your questions on our 24-hour listener line. It's the same number, live as well as recorded, 888-99-CHART. And we try really hard to get to your questions the very next day when you leave them on the 24-hour listener line. Today, when Warren Buffett breaks his own rules, what rule is that? His number one rule, what is that? Never lose money. That's his number one rule. What's his number two rule? Follow rule number one. That's his number two rule. Anyways, that's going to be one of our talking points today. We're going to show you where he's not following his own rules. Anyways, it's just interesting. In my most recent market commentary this week, I talked about inflation. And since the Fed did follow through on their forewarnings and did raise rates yesterday by a quarter point, it seems like a good idea to discuss the concept of inflation. Inflation is finally gaining a little bit of traction, as I recently wrote, okay? And we're seeing hints of its acceleration of inflation. Now, don't misunderstand this. I'm not saying that we have high inflation because we don't. We have very little inflation, and the gains have been microscopic, but they are consistent. That's the important part. Inflation looks like it's gaining traction, okay? And that's based on their most recent reports. From a wholesale level, it's up 2.2% in the last 12 months. Wholesalers are not always able to pass along the increases to retailers and thus to the consumer, and we saw that in the CPI number that came out today. It's not very much, about what is expected. But in February, the rates were up 0.3%. In the CPI. Now, the CPI and the PCE, which is the Fed's preferred gauge of inflation, PCE, has been rising in recent months. Again, the rise has been small but steady. That's actually a good thing. You know, people think higher inflation is bad. No, runaway inflation is bad. Higher inflation is not something that's bad. It's better than deflation. Which is where everything becomes more expensive because what happens is you get in a cycle of deflation, prices are lower, but what happens is your salaries start to collapse too, and it's a cycle going the other way. So you think initially everything's it's great because you get to buy more stuff at cheaper prices, but it gets into a cycle very difficult to break, and if you don't believe me, just look at Japan from 1989 on. So inflation, small inflation, is everybody understands it. Everybody knows how to adjust for it. So therefore, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It really isn't. Now, do you have questions about the effects of inflation on your invested dollars? Well, I'm ready for any money questions you want to talk about. 888-99-CHART. Let's go to the phones and take that first question. And it's live. We're going to talk to Floyd in Fremont. How are you doing, Floyd?
Hi, Steve. Hey, I have a question about bonds. I'm trying to add fixed income to my portfolio. And I'm wondering about the yield to maturity. Is that the only number you really compare? You have two bonds with similar risk, with the same risk, and similar maturity dates. But what if they have the one bond has my total cost? Let's say if it's $5,000 for five of them, and both of them are similar in almost every way, but one bond have a total estimated cost of, let's say, $5,200, and the other bond has a total estimated cost of $5,500, yet the yield to maturity number is similar, almost the same.
Okay, so then what? Yeah, what you worry about is a yield to maturity number, Floyd. What they're trying to,
and that's
what,
the only thing.
Yeah, really. Once a bond has been issued, remember bonds are issued at par, but after their issuance date, now you have to buy them in the open market, and that bond was $5,000 at par. But then after that, it depends on how the value of that bond goes up and down based on what interest rates are doing. So you want to know, well, how much money do I get back? Because remember, you're going to get back $5,000 when it matures.
Right.
You pay $200 more than $5,001 and $500 more for the $5,005, you know, for the other. Now it's a matter of, well, how that I would probably suspect the one that is higher, the 500, either the maturity date is further out, longer, or it pays a little bit more interest. One or the other or a combination of those two.
Okay.
But for you, buying it after market, your yield to maturity is your most important number.
Important number. Yeah. Okay, well, what if one bond comes with a yield to maturity? I have two bonds that say they're the same, with the same risk, the same maturity and everything. Okay. But one bond comes with, both bonds come with a yield to maturity, right?
Right.
But one bond has a yield to worst, and the other bond does not. Most bonds do not come with a yield to worst on my broker's website. So is there less risk in a bond that tells you what the yield to worst is?
Well, what's nice about that is that it is giving you a floor. You know, so you do like that. And just so you know, Floyd, and for everybody else out there, this discussion we're having, we're just scratching the surface of bonds. Because, Floyd, nowhere have we discussed the quality of bonds yet. Okay?
Right.
What are the quality of the bonds that you're looking at? You know, and then that goes to how much yield you're going to get and how much risk premium you should have. Bonds are not easy. People think they seem easy because you just buy them and you hold them, and they're not that easy. Yeah. So I think you're discovering that, Floyd.
Now, the yield to worst, is that written in stone? I mean, if the company went bankrupt, are they saying that the worst I will do is that yield to worst?
Not necessarily, because bankruptcy goes, what happens when they file bankruptcy, if they go bankrupt, the judge decides who gets what, how much money. Now, the bonds are higher, you know, you get paid first over the stockholders in a bankruptcy situation.
So I'm wondering what do they mean by the yield to worst. I wonder how do they calculate that if they're not going to throw in a total bankruptcy in that.
Well, there's going to be some promises and guarantees, and there's probably, bonds can be insured, you know. The issuer can insure the bonds so that, you know, you won't take any more loss than the worst. And I have a feeling that might be what they're talking about. I'd have to, you have to do the research on what the bond, but that might be what that is referring to, because they have insurance to protect you, the bond holder, to some degree.
Okay. One last question. I know that you don't like,
bond funds.
So to speak, bonds that are not, investment grade. Listen, but what about companies? A lot of times I look at the issuer of the bond. I go to the stock symbol and look at the stock symbol. What if the stock symbol looks, you know, this underlying stock is pretty solid. Does that make, but the bond that they're issuing might be sub-investment grade. Is that any kind of security, you think?
Yes, that does play a role.
Underlying stock is strong?
Yes, it does. If the underlying financials of that company, the underlying longevity of that company is very solid, then I would go below investment grade. I would.
Okay, that's my question. Hey, thanks a lot. You've been very helpful.
Thanks. No problem, Floyd. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay. Well, that was a long bond conversation, everybody. And I know that it probably bored a lot of people, but bonds are important to understand how they work. It's very, very important. When Warren Buffett makes his own rule or breaks his own rule, that's one of our talking points today. Do I have time for the rest? Anyway, I got others, but we'll talk about those after this break. I'm Steve Peasley. You're listening to Live Invest Talk, live 4 to 5 Pacific Time, 888-99-CHART. Let's go talk to James in Sonoma. How you doing, James?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I'm calling. I have a friend of mine who's going to do this, and I'm sort of shaking my head at this. I know you hate annuities. He has a 401k. He's going to take the money out of that, or his financial advisor said he's going to take it out of that, put it into an IRA, and then the IRA is going to convert to an annuity. What he is he's house rich and 401k
poor.
Rich, but cash poor. And he says, I got to have income. And now what they're telling me is by doing that, that takes that away from the RMD. And I just don't think, you know, I looked it up on the internet, and it says that doing that is like wearing a raincoat indoors.
Exactly.
And I'm just wondering what you guys thought about that. And I think there's got to be a better way to do that, to generate cash with putting an IRA in a, or putting an IRA in a, annuity and an IRA.
It never makes sense to buy an annuity in a tax deferred instrument, because annuity is a tax deferred instrument, you see. So,
yeah.
You know, so, but you're putting a tax deferred instrument inside a tax deferred instrument. That, you're just adding layers of cost, basically, what you're doing. And really, your net result is not going to be any good. It's not going to, he's going to be very unhappy 5 years, 10 years, whenever he wants to cash in that annuity. He's going to be very unhappy because there's going to be all these little situations which they're not going to tell you that's going to cost you. But it's not a good idea. I don't hate annuities, but especially for older people, they are not the answer. They are not the answer. If he's looking for income, there's a way to build an income portfolio without buying an annuity. I wish he would talk to somebody, because I wish he'd talk to his accountant. Get his advice.
Well, he's talked to me, and that's what I've done. I have I have all dividend paying types of stocks, and some bonds and some preferreds. I've had years and years and years, but he's not going to cash this in. This is going to be one of these annuities that's for life that will help him make his house payments and all that. He's got a beautiful house, don't get me wrong, but he doesn't have like a retail account. It's all in that 401k, and he's has to generate the cash, and that's. And he says, well, this way it's not correlated with the stock market. And I said, well, again,
Thing. So he's given his money to the insurance company then? That's what it sounds like. He's annuitized his 401k. He gave his money to the insurance company, and they're guaranteed to pay him back a certain amount every month or whatever. Is that?
Well, he only gave his financial advisor, he only took a third of it. So it's roughly about $600,000 or $700,000 that will go from a 401k to an IRA, then it will become annuitized, or they will buy an annuity in that IRA, and then in a couple of years it will start generating. I think he said it's going to generate about $3,500 to $3,600 a month for him.
Okay, so that's what, about 4.5% on the $600,000.
Yeah, but it's probably his own money back.
You can generate 4.5% without a tremendous amount of difficulty buying good quality bonds, ladder them, and high dividend paying stocks. And my balanced income portfolio does that, and it's paying 4% right now. 4%. And that interest rate, that will go up as time goes on. It's not a good use of his money, James. It's really not. I wish you would talk to somebody else to get a second opinion on that. This is the Best Talk, everybody. I'm Steve Peasley. Give me a call, 888-99-CHART. When Warren Buffett breaks his own rule, that's going to be our talking point today. But I also want to talk about margin debt. Did you know we're at record highs again? Do you know what that means? We're going to discuss that. And I haven't mentioned this in a while. Do you know what a secular bear and a secular bull market is? The cycle, the secular bear and bull market cycles, and where we are. I'm not talking about the seasonal cycles that happened every year of the markets, but I'm going to talk about that too. And the Fed did not get the reaction they wanted, according to Goldman Sachs chief economist. The Federal Reserve did not get the reaction it was looking for from the marketplace when they raised rates. So what did he mean? What is he talking about? Those are going to be our talking points today. Of course, always, as always, your point of view, your questions always come first. The market was kind of down, mixed. The Dow was down 16. The NASDAQ was up 1. And the S&P down 4. So I usually go by the S&P 500 as to the real direction of the market because it's 500 stocks where it represents 80% of the market cap, market capitalization of the entire market, whereas the Dow only represents about 20%, the 30 very large companies. The NASDAQ represents, I'm assuming probably about 35, 40%. I'm not sure, quite sure. So the S&P 500 is a bigger representation. There are better indexes out there, everybody. No one just talks about them. You can have better indexes. You got the Russells and the different types of indexes out there that cover the entire market or 90% of it. But everybody's familiar with the NASDAQ and the S&P and the Dow. The Dow because it's the oldest. And if you really want to know the truth, the Dow is not a good representation of the overall market. It's not. It really isn't. But that's what we're dealing with. So the market was kind of slightly down today. So what do you want to talk about? Let's go to our 24-hour listen line. We have a voicemail there. 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Steve and Justin. I'm interested in the ETF, EEM. That's E for Echo, E for Echo, M for Montana. It's an ETF tracking the emerging markets. I wondered what you thought was a entry price for this ETF and whether it's sort of moving sideways now or whether you think that it will continue to go down over the forthcoming months. Many thanks for your help. I really enjoy your program. Thank you. Bye.
I mean, I've been hinting at in recent months that I think, or recent weeks and months, that I think we might be seeing the bottom already being put in for emerging markets and European, the EU. For their stock markets. I think we're going to see it. Now, EEM is exchange-traded fund seeking performance corresponding to the emerging market index. And it broke out to a new 52-week high yesterday, and it added some to that today. So that is what we call a breakout on a chart. And therefore, I think we're going to have a run. It has been moving up since last May. And it moved up nicely. Then it corrected from about $37, $38 back down to $34. And then that happened in November. And then it put a double bottom once in November and once right at the end of the year. And then it started to move up. Now it had a little correction again. And now it's broken up to a new 52-week high. So to me, it looks like the chart is in a solid upward pattern. And, yeah, you might get some weakness in the next correction we have. But my gut feeling here is you should buy maybe half a position now that it's broken out and maybe wait for a pullback and buy the other half position. That's my gut feeling on this. I just think that we've seen the bottom in emerging markets. It's starting to get hints of their economies improving, both emerging markets and Europe. If not improving, at least bottoming, you're getting their central banks are starting to talk about not being loosening more of their buying more bonds or increasing their balance sheet or trying to make their currencies be weaker. They're not talking about that anymore. They're not discussing it. They're really talking about, well, maybe. You know, we're still going to do our QE, but, looks like maybe we won't continue it for indefinitely. They're talking like that instead of saying, we got to do something, you know. So I think we're seeing the possible turn in emerging markets. I reserve the right to be wrong, but I think I'm going to go with it. I'm not keen on buying anything there myself. I will say that. But I'm not also not opposed anymore. We're at the halfway mark of this Thursday Invest Talk, everybody. We're counting down to our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference in San Jose. That's next Saturday, March 25th. You can sign up on investtalk.com. You can do it right now. So let's hear your money questions. 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast continues next, but a couple of words first. for KPP Financial, helping you make smarter choices. Many of our clients and listeners are invested in their employer's 401k plan. In the past, it's been very difficult to provide timely information and suggestions for these types of accounts. Well, here's a program that changes that. It's called Active 401k, and it helps you take a proactive approach to managing your employer's retirement program. Here's how it works. Active 401k ranks your current 401k investment options within your employer's specific plan based on current trends and long-term performance, and then it builds a portfolio that fits your personal risk tolerance, selected from the plan's available options. To find out more about it, just go to investtalk.com and click on the Investments tab. Now, back to our podcast. InvestTalk continues. Next time, the market will go through some turbulence in the next 4 years, but long-term investors shouldn't stress. A new president requires a classic strategy. That's one of our topics next time on Invest Talk. We hope you can join us.
888-99-CHART. We're going to talk to Arias in San Diego. How are you doing, Arias?
Pretty good. You, Steve?
I'm good. I thank you for the call.
Quick question for you. With Donald Trump's America First and Workers First program, I guess.
Yes.
How is that being viewed out in the business world of companies? I see where China and Germany, I guess, Xi Jinping and Merkel have, you know,
they don't like it.
To go against Trump's protectionism.
Yeah.
And I know that Trump hasn't done well with the Mexican president.
Nope.
So he seems to be creating a lot of enemies here. So how is that going to be viewed around to our economy and things of that nature? Just want to get your points on that.
Okay, of course, his supporters, we don't want to talk about politics, everybody. I don't want to get into it, but we don't have to talk politics.
Yeah, I understand, but just for the market.
Yeah, we can talk about how it affects market and companies and earnings, and that's what we'll address. And if you'll pay, and I'm sure you have, Ari, been paying attention, the companies like what they hear, mostly because they like he's going to reduce taxes. They like he's going to reduce paperwork, red tape. Those two major things they like a lot. They don't really care for, they don't like it, that he is becoming, he's going to be a hawk on trade. Okay, because when you tell people you're going to America First, then you mean, and he wants to renegotiate all the trade deals and everything. Well, you got to remember the S&P 500 companies, about 50% of their earnings come from outside the United States. That means trade, right? So they don't like that part, but they like the first two parts. And so far, that's what they've been focusing on. And they haven't really, you know, and if you pay, have you ever read any of Trump's books, especially the one, The Art of the Deal, the first one that he wrote? Trump,
I
think most of the market participants, corporations, think remember, it's The Art of the Deal. This is how he's going to approach it. He's still going to make deals with every one of these countries. But he wants to come off first as, I'm going to do the demand. And then he gets in there and negotiates. So I think what you're seeing is a lot of corporations don't believe he's going to be that negative on trade. They believe he actually is going to negotiate better deals for everybody here in the United States, but still do deals.
Now, let's say, because I know that the companies and corporations are banking on less corporate taxes, lower regulations, and things of that nature. But how soon will he get to them?
That's an excellent question.
It's not going to happen in 2017, for sure. That's done.
Yeah. He's not going to. You know how long it took to get Obamacare passed? And Obama had a total Democratic House and Senate, much bigger majority than the Republicans have now, and that majority was all on the same page. Here you have Republicans not us on the same page. How are you going to get that health care passed this year? I don't think so. Yeah.
Now, if that's the case, you're looking at Because it took Obama, I think, about 2 to 3 years.
Correct. That is correct.
If it takes President Trump that long, his first term will be up.
Exactly right. And when's it going to start?
Where do you think we will be then in the market?
The market will have a pretty big correction. It will not. Eris, if you want to know the truth, I think the market's made most of its upward run already this year.
Okay.
I think it made, because now the hard work comes into play. Well, where's your tax break? Where is it? Have you passed it? Yeah. Are you even got a bill in front of Congress yet? Where is your reduction of red tape? You can't do everything by fiat from the Oval Office. You can't, executive orders only go so far. You got to get laws passed. There's been no laws passed, Arias.
None. I got it. Thanks, Steve.
Appreciate the call. So, yeah, the market likes it so far, but the market does not have infinite patience. It does not. So there'll be something. Anyways, margin debt. Did you know that we're at record highs on our margin debt again? 2 years ago, we were at highs too. So the New York Stock Exchange said that there's $513 billion of margin, meaning investors borrowing money to buy stocks. That was as of January 31st. That's a record. The preceding two records were just before the dot-com implosion and just before the financial crisis implosion. Those were records too in those areas. Now, just because you had a record doesn't mean the market's going to go down, because it was at a record 2 years ago too. But a record in margin debt always has marked a market top at some point. We just don't know when the slide is going to fall. We don't know no one knows that. I keep telling you that. No one knows that. Now, you have people making excuses as why there's record margin debt, and that's because the debt is so cheap that people borrowing money at very cheap rates. And therefore, that's why it's records. But you know what? When we are always at an extreme, and I'm not sure if we are extreme, I'm not saying we are, but there's always reasons and justifications for the extreme. The dot-com extreme. Remember that? Do you remember the justification? It's a new paradigm, a new way to do business. This is the new reality. This is a whole different way of conducting economic growth. Uh-huh, sure. It still came down to, did you make money? Did you make money? And a financial crisis, mostly caused by housing. You can lend money to anybody because prices just keep going up. The property values keep going up. So you're always going to have a profit. No matter, even if they can't afford the mortgage, it doesn't matter because, their property values go up. So you can't lose. Yeah, right. So there's always an excuse to why something is at an extreme. Are we at an extreme in margin debt? Maybe not, even though we're at records. Seems high to me, and I don't like, that's just another little nail in the coffin to me that, man, someday we're going to have our comeuppance, but you still have to ride the ride as long as the market is doing what it's doing. You can't give up yet. You can take some profits off the table. That's okay. We're counting down to our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference on the 25th of March, everybody, in San Jose. If you haven't been to one of these, it's a great opportunity to explore our topic in depth. We really like it. If you have not been to one, it's all about teaching, learning something new. It's 9 to noon, 9 in the morning till 12 o'clock. And we have, we feed you. We give you, breakfast, continental breakfast kind of thing, and then a cookie break, It's all about learning. This conference is going to be learning the professional approach to accurate research, fact-based analysts, and winning strategies. How to do this. And we're going to try to, the first part, we're going to try to show you how you can find things, okay? How you do your own research. How do you pick stocks? How do you do that? And then we're going to show you how we do it what experts use, okay? The tools that we use. We're going to try to give you some of your tools that you can use, that you can find on the internet. So, if you're not the hands-on type, but you have money under management, or you're doing the best you can on your own, This is a way to, you know, give you some good professional insight. March 25th, Saturday morning. It's at the San Jose Hyatt House, 9 to noon. You can register online at investtalk.com.
What's in it for insiders? Become an InvestTalk insider and find out. One thing, webinars. You'll have access to a whole library of webinars that you can play anytime. It's free. Never a charge for any of the useful content. To sign up, just go to investtalk.com and click on the InvestTalk tab.
Hi, yes, this is Daniel in Menlo Park. I just had a quick question. I listen to you every day on 1220. Big fan. I just had a quick question about commodities and just wondered when you thought was a good time to get back into them. That would include gold, silver, rare earths, and if you had any suggestions on any symbols for all three categories. Thanks so much.
Well, we never got out of our precious metals, and we, you know, of course it bounced up strongly yesterday because the dollar weakened. We never got out of it. We stayed with them. If you got out, I suggest you get back in. Now, don't go crazy. You know, I'm not saying put all your money back in. I'm just saying that, you know, if you, like, for instance, if you wanted to buy oil, I'd probably wait a little bit longer on oil. I think it'll come down and get a little softer sometime this year. Gold, I think, you know, you get into it now. I think it's already had enough weakness. Therefore, you know, it's now last couple of days trying to make a, and you see how fast it moves. It moves pretty darn fast. And you watch the dollar. You've seen the dollar move really strongly down yesterday after the Fed raised rates. What does that tell you? Normally, when the Fed raises rates, that is indication that the dollar should be stronger, not weaker. But what it told you is, you know, that old saying, buy the rumor, sell the news. Well, the rumor was the Fed was going to raise rates. So the dollar started moving up. When the Fed actually raised rates, you sell the news, sell the dollar. The dollar went down. Buy the rumor, sell the news. Very common in our industry. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, people that are not familiar with the market don't understand why it goes up and down on a day-to-day basis in the direction that it is when it seems to be, you know, in the wrong direction based on the news. That's because it already moved. Remember, we investors are always trying to anticipate what's going to happen. Always. So, and that's what we saw. So it looks like the dollar, you know, got very weak yesterday. It started to weaken 4 or 5 days ago after being strong for about a month, going up and up and up and up. But notice it didn't reach the previous peak it made in December. Kind of interesting. Shouldn't the dollar get stronger if our economy's getting stronger? The answer is yes. But maybe the strength it's had for the last couple of years has already been built into the dollar. And maybe if you're seeing hints of emerging markets and the EU, which I mentioned earlier, not more than, 15, 20 minutes ago, if they're getting a little bit stronger or getting a little bit better, wouldn't that put downward pressure on the dollar no matter how strong we get? Yes, it probably would. Isn't this fun? It is so complex. That's what makes it fun. I think so, anyways. I like it. Okay, what our main talking point is about Warren Buffett and why he violated his number one rule. His number one rule, never don't lose money. His number two rule, follow rule number one. Don't lose money. So the reason why this even is brought up is because, you know, IBM and Apple, they're kind of, you know, maybe they're at the higher end of their price point, so why is he continue adding to them? And basically, it's because he likes to buy companies that make money. Big, long-term, well-managed, long-term money makers, and that's why he bought them. I mean, he looks at it this way. The companies that he buys, he feels he owns the company, that degree of whatever ownership he has. Therefore, the money that they make is his. So if he has 9% of IBM, for instance, then 9% of those earnings are his. So he spent, I don't know how many billions of dollars to get to that 9%. But, you know, the money that they earn, I think they earn $14 billion. Let's see, Berkshire spent on IBM close to $14 billion. Okay, that's a rough estimate because nobody really knows. And that's about 7.6%. Anyways, the net result is he thinks that he gets about $1 billion a year earnings for his investments of $14 billion, because that's how much percent is of the company he owns that, you know, that represents. So that's how he looks at it. He thinks he can get his money back, all his money back in about 10 years. So that's how he looks at it. Then after 10 years, it's all profit, 100% profit. Remember, he looks long term. Now, I find it interesting that not too long ago, he was death on any tech stocks, and he's been buying huge recently in IBM and Apple. Those are tech stocks. I hate to mention that to him. But he said he doesn't like tech stocks because he can't understand them. That's a quote from him. Anyways, secular bear on bull markets. Do you know what that means? I want to talk about that before the end of the hour today. I really want to get into it. Coming to terms with investing. Here's an investing term you should understand. What is the debt to equity ratio? Debt equity ratio is a debt ratio used to measure a company's financial leverage, calculated by dividing the company's total liabilities by its stockholders' equity. The debt to equity ratio, D/E, indicates how much debt a company is using to finance its assets relative to the amount of value represented in the shareholders' equity. It's a pretty simple formula. Now, you got to be real careful, because when a company borrows more and more and more money, it looks like their return on equity is getting better and better and better, and it may not necessarily be so. So you got to be careful about how debt affects the financial ratios in the company. And some companies, that's the only way they survive is on debt. Banks, they survive on debt. That's how they grow their business. Most other companies, debt is not necessarily your friend. I would say it's not your friend. You're listening to Invest Talk. Our last segment of the hour is coming up, but we still can fit your question in. 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Steve. How you doing? My name is Jake. I'm calling from Chicago. I'm a podcast listener. I had a quick question about a certain ETF. I just opened a Roth IRA. I have a 401k through my employer, but I just opened a Roth account, and I wanted to load up on VOO, that's the Vanguard ETF. I was wondering your thoughts on, is it a good time to enter the market, or should I hold off until we see prices decrease a little bit? Just wondering your thoughts on that. Thanks a lot for the help, and love the podcast. Thanks again.
Well, I'd much prefer you to buy it on a pullback, because it's right near its 52-week high. It's been screaming up since Donald Trump got elected. It just seems like, you know, optimism of him being elected is starting to wear off a little bit. And I would much prefer you. I like the purchase. VOO is the S&P 500 for Vanguard, which is, you know, low cost and very good. But it would make me feel more comfortable if you bought it at a lower price. The difficulty about waiting on anything is, what if it keeps moving up? What if it doesn't fall? What if it moves up for the next 2 or 3 more months? And by the time it corrects down to an even higher level than it is today. So why didn't you just buy it? So that's always a difficulty. And then the other part of the difficulty, when? Okay, it makes a correction. How deep is the correction, and when would you start buying it? Many people, when something starts to go down, they wait, and then it turns back up and they waited too long. There's no bell to tell you this is how much it's going to correct and now it's going to go back up. I can tell you what an average correction is supposed to be, 10%. The last time we saw one that big was, a year ago, 9%. If you want to go all the way back and have a truly 10% correction, that was probably the summer of 2011. It was a 19% correction then. So, you know, it's going to be difficult. You might use a dollar cost average approach, therefore, and then you avoid trying to guess. when it's going to be soft enough for you to buy. And if you don't know what that means, go to investopedia.com, and look it up. It's pretty simple dollar cost averaging. It's a method to get into the market, ignoring the market. Secular bull and bear market cycles. Now, I'm talking about the secular. Secular part means long cycles, okay? I'm not talking about the seasonal cycles, like the one, you know, the old saying, sell in May and go away, you know, because the summers are usually weaker than the winters. The secular bull and bear markets usually last. The average is between 9 and 18 years. You're in a secular bull market or a secular bear market. And I'll give you a little history. We started a secular bull market in 2009 when the market bottomed in March of that year. We've been in a secular bull market ever since. And here it is now, 2017. This would be 8 years. Now, remember, they last from 9 to 18 years. The bear market before this bull market lasted from 2000, which was the implosion of the dot-com, to 2009. Okay, that's, you know, because that's the bottom, the market bottom in March of 2009. That's 9 years. The longest one we had was in the Great Depression, which was 25 years. Remember, I told you the average is 9 to 18 years, but you can have extremes. The one before the dot-com bull market phase, okay, ended. Remember, that ended in 2000, was a 13-year secular bull market from 1987 to 2000. Do you remember what happened in 1987? Do you? The market fell 20% in 1 day in 1987. And if you want to know that day, it was October 20th. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal that I have for that day. October 20th, 1987. Stocks plummet 508 points amid panicky selling. 508 points doesn't sound like a lot, but one day, that's 20% back then. Just think about it in today's terms, with the market at 20,000. That's 4,000 points in one day. That would scare a lot of people. Our time's up for this hour. If you'd like to contact me directly with a personal message, just click on Contact Steve on investtalk.com. That's an email that comes directly to me. I'm financial advisor Steve Peasley, president of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. On behalf of Justin Klein and everyone at KPP, thank you for listening to me today. And let's plan on doing it again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.